There's a powerful new voting bloc in America. They're white, working class, and they live in places that have been left behind.
Jackson, Kentucky is an Eastern Kentucky coal town, so about 6,000 people live there. Most people are pretty poor. The schools aren't doing especially well. There are huge problems with addiction and prescription opioid abuse. It's pretty tough.
This is J.D. Vance describing his hometown, where generations of his family grew up. It's the kind of place a lot of people would look down on. But what J.D. sees is a place where no matter how poor and hardscrabble the life, people treat each other with kindness and respect.
It was in Jackson where I first noticed that whenever the funeral motorcade passed by, everyone would get out of their cars and stop and stand at attention. And that's the only place I've ever really seen that. I've never seen it outside of Eastern Kentucky. And there was just this sense that people were a little bit slower in the ways of living and consequently were much more respectful of each other and, even after they died.
I'm Ann Strainchamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the kind of people who live in places like Jackson, Kentucky, get characterized as poor, white, and angry. Worse, as redneck and racist, hillbilly white trash. J.D. Vance knows them well. They're his people. He grew up in Kentucky coal country and the Ohio Rust Belt, places he left behind when he went to Yale Law School. I talked with him last fall, before the election, when he had just come out with his best-selling book, Hillbilly Elegy. Since then, he's moved back to his old hometown.
It's this sort of place where people are really, really proud of their families, but don't necessarily have the traditional markers of success to be proud of. So they're proud of little things that their family did. You remember that time 50 years ago, even if you weren't alive then, where your uncle or aunt did something really funny or stood up for the family's honor. Because you really did, maybe it's just that you were poor and so you didn't have a whole lot else to hang on to, but you really valued that sense that you were part of a family and that it was your job to protect your family's honor and pride of place in the world.
There are legendary stories in your family that you grew up hearing about the things your uncles or grandparents did to protect the family's honor. Can you tell one or two? Because they're such great stories.
Sure. So, a couple that come to mind. So there were famously my Uncle Pet, who was very calm but had an especially mean temper. So he had moved to Indiana when he was a teenager and had started some sort of lumber business. And somebody was dropping off a delivery of timber, I believe. And the person said, "Offload this truck now, you son of a bee." And my Uncle Pet said, when you call me a son of a bee, you're insulting my dear old mother back in Eastern Kentucky, and I'd kindly ask you to retract. And the man's name, who was Big Red, because he was a big guy with red hair, said, "Well, offload this truck now, you SOB." So repeated the insult, and Pet pulled him from the truck, beat him unconscious, and then actually ran an electric saw up and down his body. I mean, the man almost bled to death.
God.
And it's the sort of thing where it's unbelievable, except that I've heard it from so many different people, even people who don't know each other, that there has to be an element of truth to it. And, allegedly, Uncle Pet never spent a day in jail because the man who he had injured was also an Appalachian man, also had Eastern Kentucky roots, and really understood what it meant to insult a man's mother, so wouldn't talk to the police when they came around and asked him what had happened.
Mm. So it's a code.
Oh, it's absolutely a code, and it's a code that I think extends through the generations. My grandma was 9 or 10 when her older brother overheard somebody say that he wanted to eat her panties, which, of course, was not an especially nice thing to say. And her older brother, my Uncle T-Berry is what we called him because that was his favorite flavor of chewing gum, he actually went back home, retrieved a pair of my grandma's underwear, and made this 9-year-old kid eat them at knife point.
And that
was what he said, "Look, you want to eat her underwear? Here you go. Go ahead." And he made him, consume those undergarments. And that just, again, goes to show how important it was for us to, one, take on this honor code, to really internalize it, but then to defend it ourselves if we had to.
You were talking about the feeling of of loyalty and that you've got to keep the stories inside the family, in some ways, one of the worst things that happened to you, and a lot of bad things happened. You know, you lived off and on with your mother, but she was pretty unstable. Tell me about the day, a really bad day, maybe the worst day. You were pretty young, and you were driving in the car with your mom, and she got really, really mad. And you should tell the story.
Yeah. So I don't remember what had preceded this. I know that something bad had happened because I was staying at my grandparents, and mom came over to apologize and offered to go and take me out for a day of fun. And so I eventually relented, and things were going, you know, okay. And then eventually something triggered mom's temper, and she began driving very, very fast. She began yelling at me for whatever had happened the previous day. And she started to say, look, JD, I'm going to crash this car and kill us both. I'm just going to crash this car and kill us both. And obviously very, very terrifying. I was maybe 11, 12 years old. And I just remember in that moment of terror, I unbuckled my seatbelt and hopped in the back seat of the car because I thought maybe I would be safer back there. I don't know exactly what I was thinking, but this really angered her. So she pulled over the car and prepared to punish me in some way. And I just lost it. So I got out of the car. We were in a pretty rural part of Ohio. And I remember running through a rural field just trying to escape her. And I don't know how far I ran, but I eventually found this woman who was actually relaxing in her above-ground pool in this little country home that she had. And I just told her, my mom is trying to kill me. My mom's trying to hurt me. Call the police. Please call the police. So she did eventually, and about the time that mom found out where I was, the police arrived on scene, and so they arrested her and took her away, and that started this sort of domestic violence case that caused, you know, the child welfare bureaucracy to intrude on our lives in the for the very first time. Obviously, the sort of thing that was pretty traumatic as a child and caused, I think, a lot of negative things for our family down the line. You know, it doesn't just stop there. Those sorts of events leave their mark in various ways.
And yet, you sat in family court, and when they asked you if your mom had done any of that, you said no.
Yeah, that's true. And I you know, there were a couple of reasons. One, I remember the lawyer told me before the proceedings started, you know, JD, do you want your mom to go to jail? And the answer is that I certainly didn't. And I really wanted this whole process to stop. I wanted these child welfare workers out of our home. I wanted to stop doing these interviews that I had to do. But there was also this interesting cultural identity that arose from this moment. I remember sitting in the domestic violence courtroom before everything got started, and I looked around and I noticed that there were fundamentally two groups of people. There were all the people who were subjected to the court system, so people like my family. You know, they had t-shirts on, they had jeans on, they had maybe stringy hair, they were a little unkempt, they were clearly uncomfortable to be in this place. And importantly, they talked like us, right? They had that sort of Eastern Kentucky drawl. And it occurred to me that all of the people subjected to the court proceedings were like us, and all of the people who ran the court proceedings, from the judges to the lawyers, were not like us. They were like outsiders. They had what I called TV accents, clean and neutral and perfect. And I just didn't want to be part of that system anymore. I felt like for the first time that my people were being subjected to something, and I wanted that subjugation to just stop. I wanted to go and do my own thing. And of course, the irony is that that entire apparatus existed to help me, but it speaks to how strong this sense of cultural alienation is, because I just wanted those people to get out of our lives.
So when you left, you went off to, you know, college and the Marines, and then you wound up at Yale Law School. That must have been complicated for you, because you must have felt like you didn't really fit among the elites. But did you also sometimes feel like a traitor to your class?
Oh, yeah. I felt like both of those things in pretty large volumes, probably. On the one hand, I definitely felt and didn't quite appreciate this until I got to Yale, that being a member of the elite was less about money, which is what I assumed, and it's more about cultural belonging. It's more about knowing how to conduct yourself at a networking dinner, how to navigate through these informal career and educational networks. So there was a sense in which I just didn't know how the elites actually lived their lives, and I had to learn a lot. But on the other hand, I did feel a bit like a class traitor because home was continuing on apace, right? I mean, it was while I was in the Yale Law School that I first heard about my mom doing heroin, which, you know, she had struggled with addiction for a long time, but heroin has a very certain ring. And I knew that back home, my aunt and my sister were dealing with all of this while I was going to lectures with Tony Blair and talking with my classmates about how their six-figure salary wouldn't be enough to afford a nice preschool in Manhattan, right? I mean, there was just this unbelievable disconnect between the life that I felt like I was slowly moving into and the life of people back home. And it created, you know, almost something like survivor's guilt. I just felt like something I was doing was fundamentally unfair to the community that I came from. And I don't know that that feeling will ever totally go away.
Mm-hmm. Because this is something I've puzzled about reading your book. Because to the people that you grew up with, I would seem like I am one of the elites. My father's a university professor. I went to an East Coast liberal arts college. I work in public radio.
Right.
And yet, one of my grandmothers grew up as a real hillbilly in southern Missouri. I mean, barefoot, flour sack dress. She spoke a dialect so thick she had to teach herself standard English after she left home, which she did as a teenager. That's just a couple of generations difference. So why is there such a gulf between the people you came from and me?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that I have a great answer, but my sense is that it's not just something that's transpired over the generations. It's something that's happened just in the geographic isolation that's happened in a lot of these communities. It's just a matter of fact that there are certain cities and certain regions that have collected a large share of the upwardly mobile, well-educated population of the country. And so those areas just feel sometimes like foreign countries. And it doesn't even necessarily require a couple of generations. I really think that if I wasn't so self-conscious about where I came from and about trying to maintain some sort of connection, that I would have already lost a big chunk of any credibility I had with folks back home, because the problems that people encounter in most of my life right now are just fundamentally different from the problems that folks encountered or still encounter back home. And I really don't know, you know, obviously there's always been a class divide in the country. There's always been the elites versus the non-elites. But I really don't think that the divide has been quite as wide as it's been in the past 20 or 30 years.
Listening to you, I think, looking at the two candidates who are running for in the presidential election right now, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, you know, to a certain extent, I wonder whether either of them gets it and why either of them would be appealing to any of the people you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, as someone who's not a huge fan of either, I suppose I agree with what you said. I think that what is mostly driving the voter preferences, which if you look at the white working class voting preferences, looks like they're going to go pretty disproportionately for Donald Trump in this election. I think it's mostly that sort of resentment that we talked about towards the elites that's driving more of a negative feeling towards Hillary Clinton and frankly towards a lot of the other Republicans who preceded Donald Trump, which is why they didn't win. People recognize that Donald Trump maybe is a little full of it. They recognize that he doesn't share a lot of their values or share a lot of their experiences, but he's almost this proverbial middle finger. He's saying things to the elites that a lot of voters wish they themselves could say. And so I think he's able to channel a lot of frustrations, even though people don't feel that positively towards him.
He speaks to that pride we began by talking about.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. A lot of these people just want to be seen. They felt so invisible, so looked down upon by the political process for a long time, that Trump, even though he's imperfect in a whole lot of ways, is able to capture the passion of a lot of folks because he sees these people. He tries to speak to them. He recognizes that pride and honor that they have. And he exploits it in some ways, even though a lot of people don't think that he's the solution so much as they think that he's a person who recognizes that they're struggling and tries to go after them, which at the end of the day, they've felt so ignored for so long that the bar is pretty low, and Trump clears that bar.
J.D., thank you so much for talking.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
J.D. Vance is the author of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about being poor, broke, and white. Country musician Brandi Clark has been there, and she sings about it. She's 40 years old, and she just won the Country Music Awards Song of the Year. Plus, she was nominated for Best New Artist. Charles Monroe Kane recently caught up with Brandi, along with her guitar player and backup singer Miles Aubrey, in a studio in Nashville to talk about her latest album, Big Day in a Small Town.
Well, let's start with, tell me where you're from.
I am from Morton, Washington, which is on the west side of Washington State. It's a little valley, and it's a logging community. My dad was a logger, and my mom worked in the timber industry. And everybody that's there is somehow supported by timber dollars. And when I lived there, it was about the community was about 900 people. I think it's between 900 and 1100 at any given point.
So you have this new album, and you really firmly planted this album in Morton. I mean, literally with a map on the front. Why is it so planted there?
Well, because that's my small town. I wanted it to feel like it was any small town USA. But I think to be general, you first have to be specific. So the town that resonates with me is the town I'm from, Morton. And I think it's a lot like any small town in America, whether it's in the state of Washington or the state of Florida or North Carolina or, you know, California. I think that small towns have some big similarities.
Like what?
Well, you know, I think a focus on the high school, definitely. You know, the town sort of revolves around the football games or the basketball games, whatever in season. And, you know, there's some of that. Everybody in everybody's business. Everybody knows everybody. But, you know, the real thing for me about a small town is that people really care about each other in a way that you can't in a big city because you don't know everybody.
And right.
When I was sitting down to make this record, Jay Joyce produced it, and I had a couple of loose concepts in my mind for albums, and one of them was Big Day in a Small Town. And he said, "Well, why do you want to make a record called Big Day in a Small Town?" And I said, "Well, I love small towns." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, everybody's in everybody's business, and the town shuts down for the football games," all those same things I just said. And he said, "Yeah, that's great, but why do you specifically, what is it about your hometown that makes you love it?" And I said, "Well, you know, when I think about it, it's that when my dad died, there were so many people at his memorial service that it had to be in a gym." Hmm. And I said, "That's not the first time that I attended a memorial service or a funeral in a gym. I think that's just a small town, and I think that's special." And he said, "Well, that's a reason to make a record."
That's a reason right there. Well, if you wouldn't mind, would you guys mind sharing a song with us, a song about Morton? Anyone you want?
Oh, man. Well, you know, the one that comes to mind most to me is Big Day in a Small Town.
Sure.
So let's start with that.
Right. One, two, three, four.
Mama got a call from the principal's office. Better get down here fast, 'cause Mindy passed out when her water broke in the middle of geometry class. Her mama didn't know she was 9 months late. Been getting on her bad, gaining weight, and now she's a grandma Somebody had a baby. Somebody had a breakdown. Ah, it's a big day in a small town. There ain't no mall, no Waffle House, but there's always something to talk about around here. Somebody shot a deer. Woo! Somebody's getting married, or buried, or carried away. The sun comes up and the sun goes down. Ah, it's a big day in a small town.
You know, for me, I sat down. I have a screened-in back porch where I live, and I have a record player out there, which is great. And I played your entire album without stopping. I was by myself, laid down, had some cocktails, sat there by myself, and I was really struck about women. True tales of the idea of what it likes to be a woman, not a woman who's in conflict with a man or who wants to get a man back or who's smashing up a pickup truck. She's pissed off at a man. But the voices of real women, that to me was... was unique.
Wow. Well, I guess that means there's a lane for it then, you know?
Yeah.
I think what happens to me a lot is when I play live, and it's always the highest compliment, is a woman or multiple women will come up to me and say, wow, how did you get a hold of my diary? And that makes me feel good, because even though those stories maybe aren't being heard, it doesn't mean they're not happening and that they don't need to be told and heard. And for them to be heard, they have to be told first. And so... I'm trying to tell those stories for those people who aren't singers and writers. That's not their gift. You know, they're getting through life doing something else, but they like to turn on music and feel like somebody understands them.
You know, these women on your albums, you know, the bored housewife getting high, a jilted lover, the aging homecoming queen, the hairdresser, which I found amazing, you know, the woman with, you know, three kids and no husband. Do you know these women?
A lot of them. You know, you mentioned the hairdresser. My hairdresser's named Sherry. And she was sort of the inspiration for the beginning of that song Soap Opera, because she knows more about me than almost anybody. You know, your hairdresser is sort of like your therapist in that you can tell them a lot of things. And three kids, no husband, I think everybody knows that person. And that song in particular, that hits people a lot harder than I ever really thought it would. I underestimated the power in that song. And
when she smokes the cigarette on the porch when she has a moment break on that song, I cried first time I heard it, because... I totally get it. You know, I can imagine what that moment is like for her. You know, I'm married and I'm stressed out, and I'm trying to help my kids with their homework and all these things. And I'm like, my God, I only have two kids. She has three and she's on her own. And I just think about her smoking that cigarette. I feel for her. Can you play that one for us?
You bet. I'd love
to.
Got three kids, no husband. She's 2 weeks late on last month's rent. She's waiting on the child support. He keeps swearing that it's coming. But if she knows him, she knows where it went. And that pile of bills ain't gonna pay themselves. It's been a 40-hour week, and it's only Tuesday, and there's homework and dinner to make. Somebody wants a lullaby, somebody wants a different channel, somebody's dealing with their first heartbreak, and the dishes in the sink ain't gonna wash themselves. She lights a cigarette out on the balcony. When she gets a couple minutes to herself, there's how you plan it out and how it turns out to be. And a broken home, it ain't no fairy tale. She's got three. Job at a diner. She knows damn well she don't make the best cup of coffee, but she's quick with a smile and good with names. And those lunch tickets ain't gonna tip themselves. She smokes a cigarette out by the loaded dock and tries not to pick the polish off her nails. She thinks about a guy who's been coming in a lot. She starts to dream and then she stops herself. She's got three kids, no husband, so she's a mom and a dad and a taxi driver. When the baby's sick, she's an up all nighter, a hand and a shoulder and a referee, a real life hero if you ask me, 'cause those kids ain't gonna raise themselves.
Wow, that song is incredible. Three kids and no husband. How do you relate to that song?
I grew up, probably most people would consider it poor. I didn't, because I didn't know any different. We always had whatever we needed. My brother and I and my parents really sacrificed a lot to make sure we also had what we wanted. And so I didn't grow up around anybody who had money. Everybody was sort of in the same boat. And so there wasn't a class system in that way in my hometown. When I moved to Nashville, I definitely saw, oh, wow, there are some people who grew up in mansions as opposed to, you know, like a mobile home. When I write or sing about that, it's not because I think, oh, it'd be cool to write a song about people who are living week to week, you know? I mean, that's still me in a lot of ways. And so I understand that struggle.
When you travel around and sing in these places and go back to your hometown, what do you see?
Well, you know, it does feel like sometimes that, you know, small town America is really struggling, you know, financially. I don't think they're struggling otherwise. I mean, I think small towns will always be the heartbeat of this country. I just think whenever there's a recession or, you know, something that hits our country, I feel like small towns get hit the hardest because it's a lot of mom and pop sort of places. And sometimes those things just don't survive.
Some would say that white working class towns like Morton or where I'm from, they're not going to recover. Like, they're done. Do you feel when you're writing these songs, and I know that songwriting is to heal and to express and to share, but do you ever feel like sometimes you're documenting something with this album, like documenting the end of something?
Oh, wow, I hope not. I hope I'm just documenting a time in history. I personally don't think small towns will ever die. I think that, you know, I see my hometown, I see a lot of people that I grew up with that are now the adults in the community and have kids that go to the school. And I think as long as there are people who stick around, small towns will be around. They oftentimes have to drive a couple hours to find work,
right?
Which isn't easy. But I think there's a lot of pride in small town America. And so for that reason, I think small town America will live on. I hope I'm not documenting the end of it. That would be very sad. You know, I think that it's one of the great, like I said, I feel like it's the heartbeat of our country.
Hey, you know, we've had such a deep, heavy interview, which is great, and I think it's really beautiful, but you have such great songs that made me laugh so hard out loud. Do you mind ending with us with a song with a chuckle?
we'll leave you with something lighthearted.
All right, thank you.
One, two, three.
When you broke my heart, I wanted to cut the brake line on your four-wheel drive and poison your Pabst Blue Ribbon. When you drug my name all through the mud, I was dying to do the same, but I held my tongue, 'cause that ain't Christian. And you might be laughing now, but what goes around comes around. So I hope you have a daughter, and I hope that she's a fox. Daddy's a little girl, just as sweet as she is hot. And she can't help but love them boys who love to love and leave them girls just like a father. Yeah, karma's a bitch. So I hope you have a daughter.
This is Brandi Clark playing for Charles Monroe Kane in a Nashville studio. She and guitar player Miles Aubrey recorded four tracks for us from her new album Big Day in a Small Town. You can take a listen to them on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Rochelle Hurt, and this is my poem, In the Century of Rust. In the century of rust, the city's shoulders glittered with fiery dust. Dramatic, wind-driven, it cloaked every citizen and found its way into each of the body's hollows. It fell from their mouths in scabs when they sang too loud, yawned too long, or sighed too heavily. It left iron-orange streaks on their tongues when they kissed, so it was always apparent when two had been kissing. They had to brush their hands nightly along each other's spines just to keep their backs from rusting out. That stuff, mothers would say to one another, will eat through anything. This imagined city is based on Youngstown, Ohio, which is where I grew up in Northeast Ohio in the Rust Belt. So I wanted to sort of pay tribute to Youngstown, but also to come up with a new version of Youngstown. Everything that I had seen about Youngstown in the past was documentary style, somewhat depressing news coverage of how it's a city in decline, how it was part of the Steel Belt and is now part of the Rust Belt. I remember rust being just sort of present in the background landscape of Youngstown, and I'm not sure that I noticed it. It was like the water that I swam in. It's sort of a rusty city. There are a lot of dilapidated and abandoned buildings, a lot of rusted metal. And I guess I didn't really start thinking about it, about that landscape and how it's different from some other places until I moved away. Then I started thinking about how beautiful rust can be, actually. Of course, it's a sign of decay and disrepair, but I think it's also kind of beautiful in that it adds unexpected color and texture to urban landscapes. I don't want to glorify rust, though. You know, there are, I think, people who glorify urban ruin in a way that kind of ignores the problems behind it. But I do think that that landscape, the sort of rusty, dilapidated, gray landscape, for me is nostalgic and comforting because it's just what I grew up around. Rust signifies home for me. When I find myself in places that resemble Youngstown in that way, I do feel kind of at home. I feel at ease. I sort of take a breath, which is a strange thing. A lot of people are confused by that, like being in a falling down building as a source of comfort. But there is something kind of comforting and home-like for me about it.
poet Rochelle Hurt. During the steelmaking heyday, Youngstown was a city of almost 200,000. Now it's less than 60,000. We know what happened. The steel mills closed in the 1980s, people left, and no one replaced them. So today there are a lot of empty buildings and decay in Rust Belt cities like Youngstown. What's next? Steve Paulson sat down with urban planner Justin Hollander.
Justin, you are a prominent advocate of an urban planning idea called smart decline. What's the basic idea here?
Well, if a place is losing population, losing jobs, then the immediate public policy and planning response has always been, well, we've got to change that. We have to now turn this place around, bring new jobs, attract more people, and that'll solve it. The problem is that if you look historically, that rarely works. Instead, millions, tens of millions, billions of dollars are spent, wasted in this effort, and these places tend to continue to depopulate. And so then you have vacant buildings, you have vacant lots, you have just a general sense of a disinvestment. And so I'm not of the belief that it never works to try to rebuild and re-energize a place to be able to bring jobs back and bring people back. It's not that it never works, but it rarely works. And so when cities are facing such a problem, it's prudent to consider this, as you said, the smart decline approach as an alternative to maybe run concurrently with maybe that kind of traditional economic development approach.
Are you saying some old cities just need to die?
Not die, but the forces that are generating lower number of jobs, less people over time, those forces are larger and more powerful than the typical tools available to local governments to fight. So what we're really most often concerned about in urban planning is the quality of life for the people who live in a place. And so if you're dealing with population decline, if that's a real thing, if jobs are leaving, a mayor will typically say, well, let's like try to recruit a new steel mill to come in. I mean, like right. Something that's going to really change the economic dynamic. But that is usually really ineffective. And even if it works, it's so expensive. The study I did looked at a project in Florida where they spent $1 million per job to bring a company to the region. So it's just a question of, what are your outcomes? And your outcomes are you want to have a place where people have a high quality of life, where they enjoy where they're living. Maybe bringing more people and more jobs is not the answer. And that's what smart decline is all about.
Well, let's talk about an example here. Probably the most prominent example of this whole idea of smart decline is Youngstown, Ohio. So city officials in Youngstown are actually trying to make the city smaller? I mean, are they encouraging people to leave the city?
So many things were tried. They tried bringing prisons into the city. They tried a stadium. They tried a concert hall. They tried all these things that were going to be like the magic bullet that was going to save the city. And nothing worked. And they finally, as a community, came together on this idea that we don't need to be bigger. We just need to be better. And let's try to find a way to do that. But politics has gotten into it. And I think my understanding is the current efforts are a little bit stalled. So I would encourage you instead to look to Detroit, where these ideas have really come in full force. And that's like a case study of today, right now, where smart decline is in action.
Okay. Well, tell me about that then. I mean, what's successful in Detroit?
It started off with a real data-driven effort to understand and characterize what was going on in the city. And this happened about 5 or 6 years ago. And this was driven by foundations who are looking to try to turn the city around. That resulted in a plan, Detroit Future City, real community-based effort to try to understand what do people care about and what do we want in our future. And that plan did something which was really unique. Even though the Youngstown plan was bold, Detroit's was even bolder. And Detroit being really such a major American city, it said that it was okay that parts of the city did not grow, and it's okay if parts of the city became less dense.
So what else can a city do? I mean, I'm wondering what specific urban policies can be put in place that would carry out this smart decline.
Yeah, so if you look at most zoning codes in most American cities, residential districts, you're really only allowed to have houses. So if a house burns down, there aren't too many options. You kind of have to build a house there, or you don't do anything, and then the grass grows really tall, and it becomes a place where people dump, and it becomes a blight on the neighborhood. So I know Youngstown right now is wrapping up. They've been doing a zoning overhaul, and that's really been a key feature of it. Cleveland, Ohio just redid their zoning a couple years back and really brought in urban agriculture to say it's okay that places that people aren't moving to get turned into agricultural uses. That's, I think, the biggest driver of kind of rebuilding and redesigning cities that are shrinking.
So part of it is just to acknowledge that parts of the city will become much less densely populated. Fewer people will live there. They might turn some of their land into farming, basically. Anything else?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different types of uses that would make sense. I remember actually I talked to a reporter from Time magazine about this, and he was actually there, and that's what Smart Decline is all about, to working out of a house and had been abandoned, but they fixed it up in Detroit. And he was asking me, a smart decline thing, what is this all about? And I was like, well, you're living it, because the idea that you could turn a house into an office building for journalists, that's explicitly not allowed in just about every major American city. Allowing it, saying that that's okay. It's okay to turn houses into offices. It's okay to turn them into artist studios. These are all really attractive uses for places that are losing population.
So suppose a city, whether it's Detroit or Youngstown, really follows the script that you've laid out, and it works. In the best scenario, how will the city change in the next 10, 20, 50 years?
The quality of life living in that place is going to improve. Then the word gets out, and ultimately that can feed into long-term investments.
But are you talking about, I mean, what was once a big city then becomes a small city, but a very attractive small city?
You got it. That's exactly right.
Do
you want me to put in my words?
If you want to expand at all, that'd be great.
What maybe had always been very high density, where everyone was cheek to jowl, mixed in with each other, maybe that's not the case anymore. Maybe all of a sudden people have a little more space. It's a safer place. It's a place where there's not the kind of crime that's happening in all these abandoned and untended places. The relationship between people and nature is better, that you can create economic opportunities through farming. But let's not measure the success of the city by its population. Let's not attribute growth to better welfare. And that, I think, you know, is where the better future is, where we're looking at the quality of life of the people and not those indicators.
Justin Hollander is a professor of urban planning at Tufts University. Steve Paulson talked with him. While we're on the subject of being broke and white in America, let's add another adjective to that list: minority. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, by 2042, white Americans of European descent will make up less than half of the population. In other words, white people will soon be a minority. Philosopher Linda Martine Alcoff has been thinking about the coming demographic change. She's the author of a new book called The Future of Whiteness. And she told Steve Paulson it's time to grapple with what it means to be white in the first place.
The major thing is that whiteness is a historically produced category.
This is not a biological category. This is a historical construction.
Totally historical, and it's changeable, it's fluid, its boundaries have moved, but it was useful. I don't think it's just something people on the ground accepted because the state told them to. It was useful for cross-ethnic European immigrants to have a category that would make sense of their experience, and their experiences were different than those who faced chattel slavery or who were indigenous to the Americas. So it was a useful category, and that's why it got used on the ground. And it continues to be a useful category to mark the differences of the experience of white European Americans in the United States, their history, the current material distributions, and the way they interact with others and the animosity and distrust they may feel from others. There's a distinctness to whiteness.
Does white only have meaning when contrasted with say, black or brown?
All identity terms are always relational and comparative. That doesn't make whiteness distinct. But I think that there is a substantive content to whiteness beyond the comparison, and that has to do with the particular experience of immigration from Europe that most whites experienced, and the particular relationship that whites have to histories of slavery and annexations of land and genocides of peoples, etc. So the production of shame and guilt and the tendency toward denial and avoidance is something that's fairly specific to white people in the United States, different from other people who have different relationships to those large events of history.
You've titled the introduction to your book, The Unbearable Whiteness of Being. What exactly is the unbearable part of this?
When you face the truth of the history of countries like the United States, it's pretty hard to take. You know, not only there was this terrible histories of slavery and genocide, but there were also connected to that a set of advantages, economic advantages particularly, but also political advantages that were set aside for white populations that explain the material differences between white and black and brown communities today. So what do you do with that, right? I mean, what do you do with that if you're a young person and you didn't live in those times, but...
Well, you're basically asking, do you have to feel guilty about it if you're white? I mean, basically for having these privileges that would seem to be undeserved. I mean, the product of historical circumstances that happened centuries ago.
And this is not unique. The German nation has had to deal with this. The Japanese have had to deal with this. The Rwandan government is taking some steps around this. There's a number of places in the world that have had to deal with terrible histories and are grappling with it in different ways. I think guilt and shame are logical outcomes. I don't think they're mistakes. I think that it makes sense. The question is, what do you do with them? How do you craft a different kind of society so that you can hold your head up and be part of a positive coalition that really respects freedom and equality and the sorts of things the United States says it respects? How do you help to bring that about as a white person?
Let's bring this to the politics of the present. A lot of people say the rise of Donald Trump shows that many white Americans feel really insecure already about losing their social status, losing their power. Do you see it that way?
Yes, I do think that that has everything to do with the current election. The left and the progressives and the liberals have largely abandoned the white poor and the white working class. They haven't spoken to them directly about their particular circumstances and have left them to the forces of the right wing, who have articulated an answer to the problems that the white poor and the white working class experience in their daily lives.
Aren't these the groups that white liberals are supposed to be representing, the poor?
Yes, but they don't. I mean, you can look at the policies of the Clinton administration and see that there was no bite behind that rhetoric. And they haven't, you know, really addressed it directly to talk about. I think people are afraid to talk about whiteness. They'll talk about other racial groups, but to talk about whiteness, there's been a lot of avoidance. And I think there's also a lot of scapegoating, actually, of the white poor, that this is where the racism lies. It doesn't lie with the elite. It's a problem of Joe Sixpack, which is the majority of white people. So they've really been abandoned. And there's some political theorists today who are arguing overtly for that abandonment, that we can win elections with an alliance of people of color and educated whites, and we don't need to address the white poor, the white working class, which is abandoning their economic plight as not meriting our attention, and abandoning sort of their sense of who they are in the country and their sense of their place inside a progressive coalition.
What would it mean to address that?
It would mean to talk to white workers and the white poor directly as whites, to address the problems of race and racial identity with them directly. What's going on in the current election is that white workers have, you know, unions have declined. They no longer have a space in their unions for being sort of political participants, for having a voice, for having any kind of democratic say over their lives. So class solidarity is just a non-starter. There's just no place to really enact class solidarity for whites. So they have replaced it with race solidarity as a way to try to protect their interests and take care of themselves.
Well, the title of your book is The Future of Whiteness, and as we've already said, white Americans will soon be in the minority. What do you see as the future of being white in America?
Well, I don't think the hysteria is going to die down anytime soon. I think there will be an ongoing polarization among whites themselves over how to address the demographic changes. They'll be organizing on the right, but also an increasing disaffection for many whites about illusions of the past. I think there's a lot of young white people in particular who just don't buy the kind of vanguard view that white people are the vanguard of the human rights. They just don't buy it anymore. And so they're trying to figure out where they stand. I'm very interested to see how they solve that question. That's going to be the answer to your question, I think, is the historical events.
That's Linda Martine Alcoff. She's the author of The Future of Whiteness, and Steve Paulson talked with her. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed it and maybe heard something worth sharing. And by the way, did you know that we put extra interviews and stories in our podcast feed? You can check it out on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour, with help from Raymond Tangakar and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.